I'm going to read this speech. I always say that the next one I'm not going to read, but I always do. The chief trouble with reading speeches is that you forget what you're saying. It reminds me of a story about an old university professor who'd given the same set of lectures which he'd read every year for maybe 30 years. It was on geography, I believe, or economic geography. And at one point each year, he would get to a point in his lecture where he'd say, "And each year, the Mississippi empties 500 million into the Gulf of Mexico." And year after year, he got away with this until one year, one bright young man managed to stay awake, and he put up his hand and he said, "Professor," he said, "the Mississippi empties 500 million what into the Gulf of Mexico? Is that tons, yards of earth, what?" The old man looked up. He looked down at his paper and he said, "It doesn't say." In the words of my friend Stan Freberg, I talked to earlier today, and who was very sick indeed, he is fond of saying at the beginning of his speeches, he says, "At the conclusion of my remarks, I will be available for questioning or stoning, as the case may be." Those of you who are students of advertising archaeology may recall that back before the dawn of tape-recorded history, during what we might call the early Firestone Age, a radio announcer used to say, "Hello out there." This was as much a question as a greeting. Reception was a very chancy thing in those days, you may recall, and he wasn't really sure whether anybody had been able to pick him up. But he was sure interested in getting through to those who had succeeded in bringing him in their super heterodynes. And so were they. They'd put a lot of work into it. It was an achievement to bring in KDKA Pittsburgh, KFI Los Angeles, KOA Denver. You remember, we always set them together like that, the city and the station. And the next morning, you'd brag, got KWKH Shreveport clear as a bell last night. There was even a name for this hobby, DXing. Now, I don't propose that we revive the A&P Gypsies, the Clico Club Eskimos, or the Flit Soldiers, but I do think that DXing has a lesson for us. The audience was eager to listen, and the announcer was eager to talk to them. They both knew who they were and why they were there. They enjoyed an exclusive relationship. They communicated. These two ingredients, the performer and the audience, have always been and are still the essentials of communication. You cannot do without them. But we, in advertising at any rate, have tried. Because this type of relationship cannot be mass-produced, we have tried to beat the system by analyzing the nature of the contact itself. We have tried to isolate it and reduce it to a formula. The result is, as you might expect, a very sterile thing all alone like that. We call it creativity. Creativity is very in just now in advertising. In addition to creative copywriters and creative art directors, we have creative media directors, creative production men. I have heard of creative marketing directors, creative account executives, and with brainstorming, creative receptionists. One agency man I know contends that if a bookkeeper wants to get a job in advertising nowadays, he's got to declare himself creative. But perhaps my friend was just being witty. He's the same one who, when working on an automobile account several years ago, was told that the night before in Coventry, England, the Jaguar plant had burnt down. What did they do, he said, lead them out blindfolded? Perhaps the reason creativity is so popular in advertising is because there's so little of it. Technique, yes. Creativity, no. I've always thought that creativity was a very grand and pompous word to apply to so strictured a field as advertising anyway. Nevertheless, creativity does exist, and it could exist a great deal more than it does. I think one of the reasons creativity is in short supply is that we persist in regarding it as an isolated phenomenon, separate both from the creator and from the audience who it is created for. No other popular art form makes this mistake, to my knowledge. In the theater, a play is staged by somebody for somebody. A book is inseparable from its author and the people who it is hoped will read it. Paint does not simply arrange itself thus and so on a canvas. It is put there by somebody for somebody else to look at. Now, this seems pretty obvious, but advertising, against all reason and examples to the contrary, regards creativity as a mechanical technique to be practiced by an undefined somebody on an undifferentiated somebody else. It is roughly analogous to a set of instructions for making love by the numbers, and without reference to either men or women. Advertising magazines are full of how to do it creative philosophies of this sort. Some of them are pretty inspirational. A few months ago, one of our trade journals was kind enough to ask me what my creative philosophy was. I wrote them back and said that I didn't think I had one, but in the spirit of helpfulness, I referred them to Ernest Hemingway's reply to the same question. It is a good thing for a writer to have a built-in crap detector. This would seem to be an admirable device for copywriters as well, you know, for the ad man who has everything. Except the problem is usually the other way around. So much of the raw material we are accustomed to working with is, you anticipate me, I suppose, so unmistakable that you couldn't help but detect it. So what happens is you either get used to the smell or stick a clothespin on your nose and go ahead and try to make something out of it anyway. Something roughly comparable to mud pies. There are some very clever and highly paid mud pie makers in the business and some beautiful mud pies. They aren't very nourishing, true, but nobody ever expects you to eat mud pies, even when they're made of mud. This excessive preoccupation with form as opposed to content has brought advertising further and further out of contact with its audience. It exists as a thing apart. It has become a bore. And like most bores, it has no idea that it is boring. It is like Christopher Fry's description of the woman who has never learned to yawn, and so she hasn't the smallest comprehension of those who can. Research men, especially creative research men, would dispute this, of course, because all they do is think about the audience. Advertising conception of the audience is interesting in that it consists not of people, but of consumers. A consumer is not a person, except in a grotesque sense. A consumer is a creature with a huge mouth and a huge belly, cut away so that you can see the pipes in cross-section. Of course, a consumer has two arms so it can drive a car, but only a right leg in these days of automatic transmission. In actual practice, however, the conception of a consumer will vary considerably from industry to industry, depending on whether one is pushing hair oil, shoes, funerals, or bathroom tissue. Now, this gets us to the unalterable fact that differentiates advertising from all other art forms. The ad is never an end in itself, as is a book or a painting. It always refers to something else beyond it. the product. Nevertheless, it has an obligation to its audience as people to be interesting and entertaining while at the same time fulfilling its selling function. This brings us to the question of which way duty lies, whether to the man who pays for the ad or to the person who will see it. The duty is to both, but if I had to make my choice, I would unquestionably choose the reader first. After all, it's his television set, his newspaper, his magazine, his radio. You are there at his pleasure. This is not a do-good attitude, but a coldly realistic one, and in the oldest traditions of responsibility to one's audience. I'll go further than that and say that advertisers who do not consciously try to please their audience are either paying too much for their advertising or have such a fantastic margin with which to operate that they can afford to be boring.